Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed. I'm Wensley Clarkson, and I've worked inside the underworld for more than 30 years, alongside police officers, forensic scientists, and criminals. My research has included prison visits, surveillance operations, police raids, and even post-mortems. And I want to take you on a journey into modern forensic science.
You're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics.
In each episode, we'll meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers. And we'll examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases. Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, Robert Maxwell. My guest today is John Blake, a veteran journalist and publisher of many best-selling books, with a close connection to Robert Maxwell, one of the most colourful forensic cases covered in my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. The Maxwell case is legendary in the world of forensics because after his death, three pathologists carried out separate autopsies on him. At the time he died, back on November the 5th, 1991, very aptly at Guy Fawkes Night, Maxwell was the publisher of the Mirror Group tabloid newspaper group. But he was hiding massive debts, dipping into the Mirror Group's pension fund to stay afloat. So his life was surrounded with mystery, contradiction, and controversy. And his death was even more sensational. Maxwell died when his obese body, weighing 20 stone, fell, apparently, off his luxury yacht, ironically named the Lady Ghislaine, after his daughter, who's now locked up in a prison in America awaiting trial for allegedly being billionaire sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein's madam. But back to Robert Maxwell. His death was even more sensational in many ways. But before we go into that, John, can you tell us the full extent of your association with Robert Maxwell, how you knew him and how long you worked alongside him?
Sure. It was a very strange day. I used to write a column on The Sun called Bizarre, which was like a modern day kind of a lifestyle blog, really. I wrote about rock music and clothes and restaurants and things like that. And the column was a roaring success. And occasionally I'd sort of wander around the country and do the column from different cities. So I was in Liverpool with my little team, and we had a really a crazy night in those Liverpool clubs. And one guy had a gun and people were taking drugs. It was fabulous and wild. And then at about 9 in the morning, I got a phone call and somebody said, "I've got Mr. Robert Maxwell for you." Now, I'd never met him. I just heard about him. And he was this kind of legendary pirate who'd bought the Mirror Group for £120 million. And so I was bemused and I was put through to him. This was 1983. And he said, "Hello, Mr. Blake, it's Robert Maxwell here. I want you to come and work for me." And I said, "Oh, yeah, that's good." And he said, "Can you come and see me this afternoon?" And I said, "Well, it's very difficult. I'm in Liverpool." So he said, it has to be this afternoon because I'm going to be abroad for a month. So I was, I was a reporter and I was young and I was nosy. And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to meet him. So I jumped on the train down to London and I went to his office, the Mirror Group. And I was wearing jeans and a T-shirt and trainers. I wasn't dressed for it. And I was a little bedraggled after my night on the tiles in Liverpool. But he was charming. We got on very, very, very well. He offered me a job, and I had no intention of taking it, to be honest. But I thought it was very amusing, and I might get a pay rise at The Sun. But then we talked, and he said he knew how to do negotiation. He said, "Would you like a Jaguar?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love a Jaguar." Then he said, "What is your ambition in journalism?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to be a newspaper editor one day." And so he said, "Look, John, come and work for me. I promise you I'll make you a newspaper editor." "Oh, that's good." And so finally I said to him, "Look, Mr. Maxwell, it's not really central, but what was the financial situation you're proposing?" And he said, "I'll pay you whatever you want. Come and work with me." So that was the start of our relationship.
And how did it all evolve after that? Because rather than talking general terms, what specific incidents stay in your mind as being so bizarre and eccentric, which actually tell us a lot about him as a character?
Well, I'll tell you one. One time we were in Florida, and he, on the Lady Ghislaine, he was trying to buy a big magazine. I won't say which one, but he was trying to buy a big magazine out there. And he arranged a dinner for the two chief executives on the Lady Ghislaine with me. And it was very pleasant and boozy. And these American guys were, you know, worried about their future, obviously. And so they said to Bob, you know, just if you buy this magazine and we help you, will we retain our jobs? Will we have shares in the company? And Maxwell said, yeah, of course, you know, you're integral to the takeover. You'll prosper. You'll be rich beyond your wildest dreams. It will be wonderful. And so he carried on lots of wine. And then eventually the two characters disappear into the night. And so Maxwell and I had a chat over a brandy afterwards. And I said, so Bob, did you mean all the stuff you said to the chaps about having shares in the company and making them millionaires and all that? And he said, God's sake, John, he said, you're just so naive. He said, the second the ink is dry, we slit both their throats.
Charming. Well, that says a lot about him. And I think just stepping back in time, we should tell the listeners that Robert Maxwell wasn't even his real name. This is a guy who emerged out of the Second World War as a mysterious character, originally from Czechoslovakia, changed his name to Maxwell, always wanted to be accepted by people, particularly in Britain. It seems to have spurred him on in good and bad ways, wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, Wensley. I mean, he was a sort of genius. I mean, he's underrated in that way. He spoke six languages. He was immensely clever. I mean, and the story of how he got started is quite extraordinary. You know, what is not so well known, and this is, but it is a fact, and, you know, it's accepted to be true, is that he was an MI6 agent, and possibly a double agent, and possibly a triple agent. He certainly worked for MI6. He possibly worked for the KGB in Russia, and he probably worked for Mossad in Israel. But anyway, his first fortune came about because after the war, he spoke fluent German and fluent Russian, and there was a lot of scientific data and publications, very technical, but very advanced, which had been built up during the war on things like nuclear fission, jet engines, complicated stuff. But it led the world in academia. And the Germans after the war were not allowed to exploit all this material. So Maxwell managed to do a deal where MI6 financed him to take all of his data from Berlin to London. And he set up a company called Pergamon Press, and he had all of this data. And to tell you, Wendy, the idea of the scale of this operation, MI6 laid on railway trains and articulated lorries, a convoy carrying all this paperwork to London. And it was all paid for by MI6. And then Maxwell could get this stuff translated. He could sell it to universities like Harvard and Yale and all around the world. And literally, they would pay $50,000 for one particular piece of data and research. So it made him a multimillionaire. But even his origins, he was a front for MI6. It was their money. They thought it would be useful to have all this data. That's how his career as a billionaire started off.
And what about his attitude towards death? Do you ever recall him saying anything flippant? I mean, that comment about slitting the throat was obviously apocryphal, but it's still quite sinister. But are there other occasions when he talked about either his own death or the death of other people in maybe, well, emotional terms?
He had a very bloody war, and he got a military cross. But I mean, one story he would often tell, I was at many lunches with him and dinners, but one of his favourite stories he would tell, he would talk about he was going through Germany as with the British Army, as where he was a captain, as the Germans were retreating. At one point, there was a house which had about a dozen German soldiers holed up in it with all their guns and machine guns, and they weren't quite sure what to do. So Maxwell said he spoke fluent German, So he said to these, he shouted out through a loud hailer, "Come out, you will not be harmed. You know, we're the English army, you will not be hurt. Surrender. If you do not surrender, we will blow the house apart." So he said, and it worked, you know, all these chaps, they came out with their hands up. And so I said, "What happened then?" And he said, "Well, I machine gunned them all dead." He thought that was a great story. And then he said, "The English are so squeamish, they criticised me and said I behaved badly, but for goodness sake, these were the Germans."
Well, segueing right the way forward to his death, the three pathologists who carried out autopsy on Robert Maxwell certainly weren't squeamish. In my audiobook, I described what happened after his body was found. Let's have a listen.
Less than half an hour after his disappearance, a fisherman reported spotting a large body floating on its back in the sea, a few miles from where Maxwell's yacht had been cruising. Not long after that sighting, a Spanish helicopter was hovering above the remains of one of Britain's most notorious business magnates and reported back by radio, "Naked, stiff and floating." Apart from his uncharacteristic isolation on board his yacht during that last voyage, there is no clue as to what was really going on in one-time war hero Maxwell's mind at the time of his death. Yes, he'd shamelessly plundered his own company's pension fund to prop up his precarious finances. He was facing intolerable pressure. And yet, as Tom Bauer, his biographer, pointed out in Maxwell, The Final Verdict, this was not new. Anyone who had fought on the front line from the Normandy beaches to Germany, facing constant danger and deaths for months on end from the enemy's snipers and shells, was unlikely to suffer fear, and he had overcome much worse. That is not to say Maxwell wasn't concerned about his personal safety. The Lady Ghislaine had security cameras at key points, and the crew were under orders to keep watch on the gangplank when in port, in case anyone tried to board the boat. At night, the radar scanned for any vessels approaching. If Maxwell had been murdered, the assassin or assassins would have had to get aboard, force him into the sea, and escape, all without anyone hearing or seeing them. After Maxwell's body was recovered, the crew of his yacht were interviewed by an examining magistrate in Tenerife, who found nothing suspicious. There was no apparent puncture marks on his body either. There was some slight bruising, but nothing to indicate an assault. It has since been alleged that on the night he died, Maxwell fell forward over a low rail and ended up dangling for some time over the water 10 feet below. He clung on with his weaker left arm, tearing the muscles on that side of his body. Some are convinced that Maxwell remained alive in the water and shouted and waved, but that the crew heard and saw nothing. What we can say for certain is that he was 68, was in poor health, weighed a vast amount, and had a weak heart and lungs. The first autopsy on Maxwell's body was carried out in Tenerife. It found no seawater in his lungs, which would have indicated drowning. Instead, the local pathologist, Dr. Carlos López de la Mela, concluded the publishing magnate had died of a heart attack. 2 days later, another examination was held in Israel, where Maxwell's body had been flown for burial, so he could be given a hero's internment in Mount Sinai after apparently spending many years as an unofficial spy for the Israelis. This time, a Dr. Yehuda Hiss was in charge. Also present was London pathologist Dr. Ian West, whom I'd first met 15 years earlier. He had been hired by an insurance company due to make a £20 million payment out to the Maxwell family, depending on whether his death was accidental, a suicide or murder. Both men saw clear evidence of badly ripped muscles and some internal bleeding, and apparent signs that Maxwell might have put up a struggle before plunging into the water. But West and Hiss could not examine Maxwell's heart, because it was still in the laboratory back in Tenerife. Despite this, Dr. Hiss still managed to conclude that Maxwell had suffered a heart attack and drowned. He later said he could see the telltale signs in the body without needing to examine the organ itself. Dr. West disagreed. He said there was no heart attack, but that Maxwell had simply fallen into the sea and drowned, which might mean he committed suicide. By all accounts, these examinations by three respected forensic scientists were seen as highly controversial, no doubt partly because each of them felt their knowledge and skill was being questioned by the involvement of the other two. Three pathologists, three different verdicts, one body.
So, John, to sum up, some believe he was murdered, others that he committed suicide. But my favourite theory, which you know all about, is that Maxwell toppled over the edge of his yacht when he was relieving himself. That's certainly your favourite theory, John. And I think you've got first-hand evidence that he was in the habit of relieving himself in strange locations.
Well, that's true, Wensley. One time, he had a helicopter, which he amazingly used to land on his building in Holborn Circus in central London and fly all over the place. And one time I was flying with him from Holborn Circus to Oxford, to his home. We were about to get into the helicopter, and he just said, "Oh, I think I'll have a pee before I go." And he peed over the little low wall into the street on the people below. And it was some kind of alpha male weird thing. And at the time, I thought it was bizarre. So he had a habit of just peeing wherever he felt like. He'd pee against his Rolls Royce if he was out and felt the need.
That makes it sound as if that particular theory about what happened to him is probably the most likely. In the audiobook, I described how one of the pathologists, Dr. Ian West, thought otherwise and said there was no heart attack and that Maxwell fell into the sea, which suggests possible suicide. Let's have a listen.
The captain of Maxwell's yacht later claimed Maxwell's cabin door was locked from the outside. So how had he planned to get back in? Surely, if he'd just stepped out for some air or to urinate over the side, which he often did, he would not have bothered to lock the door. Most people who intend to kill themselves tend to do so fully clothed. He was naked. Another question was, why did he cause himself agonizing pain by clinging onto the side and shredding his muscles? Did he have second thoughts? Other indications emerged that seemed to back up claims that he did not take his own life. There was no note. The night his body was found, his cabin was cleaned and tidied by the crew so that his wife Betty could use it. If there had been any clues lying around, they'd been swept away. That seemed very convenient. Maxwell's wife Betty was adamant that her husband would never have committed suicide. She believed from the outset that it was death by natural causes. In the UK, the Spanish autopsy results were attacked by respected veteran forensic pathologist Dr. Bernard Knight. He was by this time the president of the British Association in Forensic Medicine. He said, "There is still no objective evidence of what happened. What we have here is a man with a heart disease and a lung disease found in the sea. The fact that he has these diseases does not mean he died from any of them." He added, "They can't prove he drowned. They can't prove he didn't drown. They can't prove a heart attack. They can't prove there wasn't a heart attack. So they are assuming. We would call this unascertained death." Dr. Knight even publicly labeled Spanish forensic medicine as backward. "Spain has the worst system of forensic medicine in Europe," Dr. Knight told journalists at the time. "Judging from what I'd witnessed following the murder of great train robber Charlie Wilson in southern Spain only a few months earlier, Dr. Knight may have had a point." Dr. Lopez hit back by revealing that he'd had access to the results of medical checkups on Maxwell made in a hospital in Nancy, France, over the previous decade. These clearly showed that his oxygen intake was progressively diminishing, It was well below average in 1988, so it must have been even more serious now, said Dr. Lopez. This once again implied natural causes were the most likely cause of death. Outspoken British forensic scientist Dr. Ian West, meanwhile, continued to declare that Maxwell's death was likely to be suicide. A claims underwriter for Robert Maxwell's life insurance policy said Dr. West had not told him that anything suggesting violence was involved in the death. As far as I'm aware, he saw no signs of any violence or any problem, said a spokesman for the insurance company. But Ian West knew only too well that if he had concluded that Maxwell had been killed, the insurers would have refused to pay the beneficiaries of the policy, which were Maxwell companies.
I think suicide is something that, if Maxwell did contemplate it, would go against everything we know about him as a character. Don't you agree?
I do rather agree with that because, I mean, this guy was a triple agent and to live that kind of, or had been a triple agent, there's no dispute about that. And he was a master of getting out of the most terrible, difficult situations. And yes, he was in a financially awful situation. And yes, he had a crush on a young woman who didn't care for him. And all. So he was not happy, but I don't think he'd have committed suicide. I think he had an incredible self-belief, Winston. I think he would believe he could get out of anything. He could have been murdered by Mossad, who knows? But my personal belief is, having seen him pee over the roof of the, you know, from the helicopter and that sort of thing, I think he just went for a wee off the back of the boat and slipped. And I think he was hanging on. You remember from the post-mortem, he tore his shoulder muscles on one arm. It looked like he was holding on for quite a long time and then eventually slipped away and had a heart attack.
Well, of course, that information you're talking about comes from the autopsy photographs that very unusually leaked into the French press about a month after Maxwell's death. And they were quite gruesome to look at. There was this whale-shaped man covered in marks, lying flat on his back, obviously. And I always thought when I saw those, I don't know if you agree, that Maxwell would have hated the fact that that was the last thing that any of us ever saw of him in terms of photographs.
Yes, I'm absolutely right. He was a colossal egotist. And, you know, a friend of mine talked to the Israeli pathologist. And apparently the original post-mortem in the Canary Islands was rather bungled. And even the pathologist admitted that they didn't have much experience with this kind of thing. And apparently by the time he arrived in Israel, they'd chucked his organs back into his body. Sorry about this being a bit graphic. But they just stuffed them into the body cavity and tied him together with rope, believe it or not, and then stuffed a lot of formaldehyde in to stop it decomposing. So when the Israelis got there, it was full of formaldehyde. They could hardly breathe. There was a rope holding the organs in. So it was almost impossible for them to work out what the heck had happened.
Yeah, that's beautifully summed up. And then we have the other pathologist, Ian West, very well known in Britain, wheeled in by the insurance company. What interested me particularly was that he was hired to double-check why and how Maxwell had died, because the insurance company were well aware that Maxwell by this stage was heavily in debt. He was borrowing or stealing money out of the pension fund of the Mirror newspapers. So there was a suspicion that not so much that he'd faked his death, but the reasons behind his death might be altered in order to guarantee some sort of insurance payout to the rest of his family. Do you believe in that?
Yes, it's true. I mean, it was £20 million. It wasn't some small life insurance policy. And, you know, in the great scheme of things, for a billionaire like Maxwell, a former billionaire, £20 million is not a lot. But he knew for his family that would keep them comfortably for the rest of their lives. And so if it was suicide, he had 20 million reasons to make it look as it was not.
And he as a character always showed a huge front. It seems like it was his whole life was a performance in a sense. Does that mean that perhaps when he was crushed psychologically by the fact that he knew that the debts and the thievery from the pension fund were about to be exposed, that he might have turned around and thought, I've got to go out in my own version of a blaze of glory and commit suicide?
Yes, I mean, that's quite possible. I mean, I don't subscribe to that theory, but it's completely possible, yeah. Although I just think he had this extraordinary self-belief, and I think he probably would have believed he could bluff his way through even this, I think.
Now, you've stayed on the Lady Ghislaine yacht from which Robert Maxwell supposedly fell. It's a big yacht, lots of bedrooms on it. Is it likely, feasible, that he would have stood on the edge at the back of it and having a pee and then fall in without others noticing?
Yes. I mean, this was nighttime. I've only had dinner on the yacht. I never actually stayed on it, just to be clear. But yeah, I mean, the rails were relatively low. He was a tall, he was in excess of 20 stone, you know, clinically obese. Yeah, I mean, it's quite possible he could have toppled over the back.
But wouldn't there be someone on duty at night?
There would be a skipper, but he would be looking where they were going and watching out for fishing boats and things like that. He wouldn't be, as far as he was concerned, that, you know, Maxwell had gone to bed, locked the door. He didn't even have to think about him. He was thinking about not hitting things and plotting the right course.
I mean, having been on that yacht, how big was it? Did it compare to, for example, the royal family's old yacht, the Britannia? Was it smaller? What sort of size, roughly, was it?
It was, I would guess, I don't know, I'd say at least 150 feet. It was a major super yacht. I mean, a tiny piece of trivial, I don't even know this, Wensley, but years later, the yacht went through different hands. The name was changed, and a lady eventually bought it, you know, with a brand new name, not knowing that it was Maxwell's yacht. And that lady was Anna Murdoch, who was Rupert Murdoch's ex-wife. And she bought the yacht out of part of her divorce settlement.
Well, there's a great irony there because, of course, we haven't said this, Murdoch and Maxwell were rivals. Although, in fairness to Murdoch, I think he was on a different level to Maxwell. But Maxwell liked to think he was Rupert Murdoch's rival. So there's an ironic twist in that, as there is with so much when it comes to Robert Maxwell. What about going back to when you were working alongside Maxwell? How about what he was like when you were working alongside him in terms of his temper and his ability to turn quite nasty?
Yeah, I mean, I ended up as editor of the Sunday People, which at the time was selling about 3 million copies. So at that time, Eve Pollard was the editor of the Sunday Mirror, our sister paper, and Richard Stott was the editor of the Daily Mirror. So Maxwell owned all three papers. So he'd invite us editors and various management people to lunch once a week up in his penthouse. And we'd all dread it because he would start off nice enough. And then he'd pick on anybody, and it could be Richard, it could be Eve, it could be me. But he'd give someone a real shouting down over something often wrong. You know, why did we... I remember one time I was told off, there was a head of Burton's who had a much publicised story about a girlfriend called Fiona. And she told in the News of the World how he made love to her 5 times a night. So she became known as 5 times a night Fiona. Anyway, the News of the World had this exclusive interview with her about all this. It was all rather tawdry, I'm afraid. And so Maxwell started shouting at me and saying, John, why the hell did we not get 5 times a night Fiona? What were you doing? And everybody was sort of quietly sniggering. And I had to carry on, you know, not smile. But it was all rather theatrical. And he didn't have a lot of malice. It was his style of man management, you know, ruled by fear. The others would all be thinking, oh, thank goodness it's not me.
It sounds like that's an insight into him as a father as well, because it sounds like almost he was treating you like his children, without getting too obsessed with cod psychiatry here. Did you feel, because of course at least two, I think three of his children were involved with the newspaper group, and we'll come back to Ghislaine later, but how did he treat his children?
Oh, horribly. I mean, Ian and Kevin were the two who were... you know, working closely with him, and he bullied them, and he'd treat them exactly the same way. He'd shout at them and humiliate them.
And with Ghislaine, his daughter, currently languishing in prison in New York, awaiting trial for allegedly being involved with Jeffrey Epstein, how do you think he would have reacted to this? Do you think he might have been someone who would have considered getting rid of Epstein, which of course is what happened to him, because he was murdered in prison, even though they say it's suicide. A lot of people think it was murder, so that he couldn't give evidence against a lot of the very important people that allegedly he enjoyed orgies with. Do you think that Maxwell would have gone after Epstein, knowing that he held the key to what might happen to his daughter?
Well, it's hypothetical, but I'm quite certain that Maxwell would have no compunction in paying whatever it took to kill anybody who threatened his daughter. I mean, she really was the apple of his eye. He adored her, you know. And I think if he would not have tolerated Epstein for 5 minutes.
What was he like? Was he a sociable person?
He was a strange man. Lonely, I think. You know, being a Sunday newspaper, I used to work every Saturday. And so he'd often just call me on Saturday morning to go up to his penthouse for a chat because there was nobody else around. You know, he didn't have any friends, really. But he'd have two simultaneous lunches. So he'd have a lunch for English politicians, say Douglas Hurd or someone like that. And then he'd have a French politician in another dining room next door, unknown to anybody. So he'd have a starter with Douglas Hurd and the rest of us. Then he'd go next door to the French lunch and have a main course with them, and we wouldn't know where he'd gone. So he'd do these two simultaneous power lunches. I mean, he was unique and extraordinary and odd.
So life was very much a performance to him. Now, we were talking about his children just now, and Ghislaine, after whom the yacht was named that he fell to his death from, of course, is in the newspapers at the moment because of her alleged involvement with Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire sexual predator. Now, she's currently in jail. How do you think, if Robert Maxwell was alive, would he be dealing with this, especially when you consider that this particular child was the apple of his eye?
Yeah, I think Ghislaine was the only one he really liked. He adored her. And he'd do anything for her, and he gave her a company Porsche and all this sort of thing. If he was, I don't know, I think if he was still alive, he'd have made it go away somehow, I think. He was a great problem solver.
Did he really have the ability to pick up the phone and talk to very important people, or was that a fallacy?
And because, if you listen to his voice, I mean, the younger people won't remember, but he had a voice rather like Winston Churchill, a beautiful, gravelly English voice. But he only learned English when he was, in his teens. He spoke Russian better than most Russian people. He spoke German better than most German people. He had an extraordinary brain, and he was very, very useful. So if, say, Thatcher had wanted to sound an idea out with Gorbachev, she might well have let Maxwell make an informal phone call. He was a very useful international go-between.
But presumably with Maxwell, it was always back-scratching, so he would expect a favour back, wouldn't he?
Yes, yes, yes.
When it came to shortly before he died, as we've said, his newspaper group was crumbling from debt. He was trying to prop himself up financially by stealing from the pension group at the newspaper, from the pensioners rather than the newspaper. Did people around him during the last couple of months of his life notice a decline in his health and his attitude and his mentality?
He became more and more insular, and he never had a lot of friends, but he just locked himself up in that penthouse at Holborn. He never seemed to go home to Oxford anymore. He was more and more quiet and despondent, and I think he realised it was unravelling. And also he was in love with a young personal assistant. It was ridiculous. I mean, she was a slim, pretty girl, but I think he took it very badly that she didn't reciprocate his feelings. And he was a man who'd been used, even handsome in his youth, and used to attracting women, and suddenly he realised that part of his life was over.
I mean, everything you're saying about it makes it sound like he must have had a lot of enemies. So in a sense, people he worked with like you, the security agencies he allegedly worked for, such as Mossad, MI5, MI6, and the KGB, they were his friends, in a sense. They were the people that made him feel good about himself, weren't they?
Yes, yes. I mean, he didn't much like his wife. He didn't much like his kids, apart from Ghislaine. So anybody who thought they were his friend, he'd usually rip them off. But you're right, he was a towering, extraordinary figure. And he was a creation of the post-war era. You know, he was somebody in those days. I mean, these days, everybody is documented. You know, we know you can get someone's DNA and know who they are in 5 minutes anywhere in the world. He was able just to pretend to be whatever he wanted to be. It was extraordinary, his life.
Now, just going back to his death in Tenerife, I think he'd been there quite a number of times. I even wrote about him in another book of mine because I believe he'd gone to meet a very senior feared criminal who he wanted to launder money through. Did he ever talk about Tenerife? Was there ever references to the underworld when it came to Maxwell?
I think he rather liked criminals, you know, in a romantic way. I'm not saying they were his friends, but if I had a story about gangsters and the people when I was the editor, I'd discuss it with him, and he loved all the details. He enjoyed that side of the world. And I mean, because, again, these people have come from nowhere and created their own identity, and that's what he did. So he'd have a certain affinity with those kind of gangsters.
Despite the theories you've got and many people have got, and of course, with someone like Maxwell, such a colourful character, the theories just keep coming. Even now, 30 years later, we hear new theories, new books are written about him. Let's hear about the theories that have popped up in the years since his death.
The mystery of what had really happened to Robert Maxwell was being tainted by huge doses of colourful speculation sparked by the big man's notoriety. However, all three experts agreed on one point. Maxwell's body had no telltale signs of someone who'd been in the sea for a long time. His skin was not shriveled from the exposure to seawater, and he was not sunburnt. Then came allegations that Maxwell had come into possession of tapes, proving British Security Service MI6's involvement in the murder of the Bulgarian dissident writer Georgi Markov, and that British security agents had killed him to ensure he kept silent. But this seems very far-fetched, and some believe this was deliberate misinformation aired in public to divert attention away from the real reason Maxwell died. Others claimed that Maxwell was fearful that his activities on behalf of Israeli security service Mossad were about to be exposed, and so Mossad had him assassinated to stop him from talking about them.
At the end of the day, these theories gave him lasting fame in certain ways. But how would you think his life would have evolved if he hadn't died that night in Tenerife?
Well, I think, you know, his goose was cooked, so to speak. I don't think he intentionally stole money from the pension fund. I think he, in his head, he was borrowing this money to prop up the share price. But he got more and more desperate. He was buying his own shares secretly and anonymously to prop the share price up. So he was borrowing money from one arm of the company to prop up another arm, and, you know, all sorts of very, very nefarious practices. But if he survived, I suppose he'd be a wealthy man. But I don't think his ego could have stood being on his own. He'd fallen out with his wife. He'd fallen out with his children. His life was a mess.
And, you know, what we haven't mentioned is, of course, he was an MP at one stage. And as a politician, I don't know how effective he really was, but it certainly enabled him to pull more strings. And one wonders in the current climate whether the way he operated, would have actually been ironically more acceptable now, when we do seem to give more time and patience towards the more gregarious characters such as Boris Johnson, who are now at the top of the political tree.
Well, that's true. But I think the trouble with Maxwell was, essentially, he couldn't resist an opportunity. I mean, a tiny story MPs will tell you is that the only office he actually got when he was an MP was head of the Commons Catering Committee, which had always made a loss. And it was in charge of the wine and the food for the various restaurants and bars in the Commons. But he was in charge of it. And he said, I'll make it profitable. And indeed, he did. For the first time ever, this thing came on, made a, you know, substantial profit. It wasn't until years later they discovered the reason it was profitable is because there was a vast cellar of wine in the Commons, beautiful vintage wines. And he sold many of these fine wines off, you know, which propped the profits up. But what nobody knew for several years was that he'd actually sold the wine to himself. So at Headington Hall, his house in Oxford, he had one of the finest cellars in Britain, thanks to the Commons.
It sounds like he was the ultimate con man in some ways. I mean, going back to his death, when you first heard about the three autopsies being carried out, what were your first reactions to this extraordinary situation?
Well, obviously, you touched on it earlier, Wensley. It's the £20 million insurance, because without that, they'd have accepted the first one in Spain. I think the Spanish one was botched, and I think they messed it up. And as I say, they put lots of formaldehyde in. It was a mess, and they tied his internal organs up. It wasn't pretty. So by the time he got to Israel, it was impossible for them to work out what the heck had happened. You know, one pathologist said that he appeared to have had something called a subdural hematoma, which is a bleed on the brain, which causes death. It's a common cause of death from people who bang their head. So, I mean, my goodness, had he been hit on the head with a club or something? But then on further examination, they found that so much formaldehyde had been used that it just frozen all the blood in his brain. So it wasn't a subdural hematoma. It was simply the effect of this formaldehyde on the blood.
Maxwell's death perfectly highlights the grey areas of forensic science. Most people out there have watched CSI, Silent Witness and other TV dramas and think it's really cut and dried and that science will solve everything. But sometimes this just isn't possible. People make mistakes. Pathologists, as you've just said, carry out inconclusive and unsuitable autopsies, which do nothing but further confuse the issue. And in the case of Maxwell, certainly the Spanish pathologists seem to be floundering. And a lot of his conclusions didn't really relate directly to the facts, which were then established by the two pathologists in Israel. Robert Maxwell even managed to confuse and confound the experts after his death. It's quite extraordinary. And I can't think, I don't know if you can, John, of anything comparable when it comes to Maxwell, not just his life, but his death in particular.
No, I agree. And I mean, you know, one of the pathologists in Israel who did the second or third autopsy suspected strongly it could have been a murder. I mean, for a long time, Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, was suspected of having killed him for various reasons. It was alleged that they'd financed his purchase of the Daily Mirror and that he'd stopped working with them in return and that they wanted to take him out. So they were desperately looking for an injection mark behind his ear or in his nose, because if they want to kill somebody, they have to give him a hidden injection. But so if you put it in the arm, you'd find it in a minute flat. But they never did find anything like that. I mean, it could be the cleverest murder of all time. And as you say, I think he'd rather have reveled in the mystery of it all. And it's going to be a television series with Netflix, his life story, as you know. I'm sure it'll be a film. It's an extraordinary story.
Forensic conclusions, as we've said, were inconclusive. But in some ways, if this had happened today, that wouldn't have been acceptable, and possibly technical advances in forensic science might have meant we'd know more. But in that case, I sometimes wonder why his remains haven't been re-examined, and obviously there's not much left of them, but in terms of DNA, who might have touched him, who might have. But I think with Maxwell, we're never going to know the truth, do you?
No, I think that's right. I mean, although my suspicion is what I said, that I think he was having a wee off the back of the boat and slipped over. But if someone, some Mossad agent, confessed in a new book that they murdered him, I wouldn't be astonished.
Then, about a month or so after Maxwell's death, John, there was a final twist when these photos emerged in Parry Match. Let's look at this more closely with an extract from my audiobook.
Sometime after the dust seemed to have settled on the story of Maxwell's death, there was a final twist. Still photos emerged, which had been taken from a videotape recording of the forensic examination conducted on Maxwell's remains at the Abu Kabir Forensic Institute in Tel Aviv on the night of 9th to 10th November. This was the autopsy jointly overseen by Dr. Ian West and Israeli Dr. Hiss. Parry Match magazine, who published the photos, claimed the examination found several bruises on Maxwell's face, shoulders, stomach and calves, indicating he was beaten before he fell or was thrown from his yacht. The magazine quoted the forensic scientists from the videotape describing the bruising on Maxwell's body. "We showed the pictures to French experts," said Parry Match. "The experts were explicit. The multiple bruises on the body of the Express magnate indicated he was attacked before his death." Loïc Le Ribault, a French police forensic specialist, was quoted by the magazine saying that, "According to the photos, it is highly probable that the victim was hit in the back of the head with a blunt instrument." Another expert quoted by the magazine stated that the injuries alone probably did not cause death. Speculation about how Maxwell died has continued to this day. Was it suicide, heart failure, an accident of fate, or murder? Not even some of the finest forensic minds in the world could come up with a final verdict on how he died. As one of Maxwell's former employees on his newspaper, The Daily Mirror, later told me, "Bob would have loved all the attention his death attracted because he was a great showman, and he'd even have had a chuckle that not even the scientists could get to the bottom of what happened to him."
Back to the photos that appeared in Parry Match. They were very gruesome, very graphic, and they shocked a lot of people. But others believe that actually Mossad deliberately fed them to the French magazine in order to try and further confuse the issue of how he really died. What are your feelings about that?
No, I think that's highly likely. And also, one of the big strong rumours at the time was that he'd faked his death. I mean, and which sounds ridiculous, but he was the kind of man who would suddenly have gone to Azerbaijan or somewhere in the middle of nowhere and lived his life out quietly when he knew the chips were up. And a lot of people believed that that's what had happened, that they'd actually got hold of some other mortuary victim, you know, similar big tubby guy, and they'd put him in the sea. And that's why the first inquest was so messy. A lot of people said initially that the body did not look like Maxwell, although one of the reasons was because apparently he dyed his hair a vivid shade of blue-black, and the salty water and the immersion had changed the colour to almost red, which is one of the reasons he looked different. So I think you're right. I think that Mossad could have leaked those photographs in order to prove that he really was dead and it really was him.
What would be the advantage to him to fake his death?
Well, I mean, he could run away from all of his debts. You know, he'd probably have, I'm just guessing, but say he'd stashed 100 million in the Cayman Islands, he could live a very quiet, lovely life, sitting on a beach with girlfriends and drinking wine and avoiding all of the responsibilities, because there was a real possibility he could have gone to prison for the way he behaved. So he had every reason to vanish.
He certainly was theatrical enough and arrogant enough to think he could get away with something like that. So is it possible that, although this might not be what happened, or may well definitely not be what happened, it's still something that he would have thought about as he was struggling through those last few months?
Yes, absolutely. I think it would have crossed his mind. He was the kind... Look, he came from a little village in the middle of Eastern Europe. He was brought up in a house without even a stone floor, had a dirt floor, chickens living in the house. I mean, and he grew to be this impressive friend of presidents and prime ministers. He was an incredible, extraordinary, unique operator, and he was perfectly capable of reinventing himself. As you mentioned earlier, you know, he invented the name Robert Maxwell. His original name, I think, was Ernest Hocht. But he changed his name many times over his life, so he was capable of doing a disappearing act.
And what was he capable of planning something like this on his own, or would he have involved other people in it?
well, I mean, somebody would have to fly him somewhere and that sort of thing. But, you know, money talks. You pay someone $500,000, they'll fly you anywhere you like. And I think it was an idea that crossed his mind. He was a master of reinvention. And, I think it's something he would have thought about, yes.
John, it's been a fascinating conversation. And, not surprising, it's Robert Maxwell. But all the same, his case really is unique. And it tells us so much about the reality of forensic science. And the fact that at the end, it's not just the science, but the investigative skills that matter more than anything else. John Blake, thank you very much.
Great stuff. Lovely Wednesday. Talk soon.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses, Robert Maxwell. In the last hour, we've chatted with journalist John Blake about the inexplicable death of Robert Maxwell. It's disconcerting how such a high-profile case is still shrouded in mystery after so many years. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. It's a free world and you can think whatever you want. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our latest episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.